And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered the Virgin Most Powerful Apologetic Dojo. And I am your sensei, your host, your friend, your all-around good guy, Gary Matuta. And, man, I am just pinching myself. I am having so much fun here on Hands-On Apologetics, talking to people. Yesterday, we talked to Dr. Kaiser about the big myths about the Catholic Church. And I was so impressed with our discussion because Dr. Kaiser, if you listened again to that program, he was focused like a laser whenever we're discussing things. He made sure that all the evidence that he brings to the fore in regards to dispelling this myth would be evidence that non-believers would believe. So, I mean, it was a really, really cool discussion. I learned a lot. I hope you learned a lot as well. And today we're going to have yet even, I just can't believe my good longtime friend, master apologist, world traveler, Steve Ray is going to join us. He's coming into the dojo and be the sensei for this hour that we have together. He'll be coming right after the first break, and I want you to join in the conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-526-2151. It's 888-526-2151. Or, of course, if you have questions that maybe you don't want to come on the show, but you're just kind of wondering about, you could always email your questions to questions@handsonapologetics.com. And I can't guarantee you'll come on the air, but I will take a look at it, see what I can do. And, of course, we're going to have our normal features. You know, we're building up for Thanksgiving Day weekend for the family gathering. So I want you to be, everybody here in the dojo, to be able to explain the faith with charity, clarity, patience, and confidence. So we have our Finding the Fallacy, which, by the way, is post hoc, ergo propter hoc. And also the Meet the Early Church Father for today is Zachary of Medellin. All right, so we got a lot going on this hour and the rest of the week, too. The guest we're going to have is fantastic. We're going to have John Martinoni. We're going to have Carlo Broussard. We're going to have Father Spitzer next week, William Albrecht. It just continues on and on. So you definitely want to, you know, make it a choice of yours to visit the dojo. Keep up on the lessons. And without further ado, why don't we jump into our segments, our normal segments. So today, the fallacy for today is post hoc, ergo propter hoc, which is Latin for after this, therefore because of this. This, by the way, is a logical fallacy that feeds into a lot of superstitious beliefs. And basically, it's this. It's reasoning that since something happens after something, it must be the cause of that something. For example, you're at a party and you have an in-depth personal discussion with your friend, and then the friend afterwards leaves. You might fallaciously argue that, well, since they left, that must be the cause of them leaving. Right? Which isn't necessarily true. We're so used to effects following causes that sometimes we misidentify causes just because the effects happen afterwards or something happens afterwards and we think it's an effect. So superstitions happen this way. This is why we have all these weird beliefs like if a black cat crosses your path, it'll bring bad luck. That happened. A black cat crossed somebody's path. Then afterwards, something bad happened. So they said, oh, well, the black cat must have caused that bad thing to happen. Or if you walk underneath a ladder, you know, or you break a mirror or something like that. So you can see how superstition happens because something occurs. And then since something follows it, they say, well, since that happened afterwards, it must have been caused by that thing. Okay, so that's the post hoc, ergo propter hoc. So impress your friends with the Latin. Why not just throw that out there? Question. Oh, by the way, I need to do my shout-outs for those watching on live stream on Facebook and YouTube. In fact, I just noticed on the YouTube forum. Gary, is that closely related to Occam's razor, right? Not really. It's Occam's razor is basically the most simple explanation is usually true. In other words, you don't want to multiply causes needlessly when you can, whatever the most simple formula works. That's more Occam's razor. With this, it's a misidentification of a cause that simply because A followed B, A must be caused by B. So hopefully that helps. Great question from the dojo in the YouTube section. So, you know, I wish I could give you props, and I guess I did. So good job. They're in YouTube land. All right. Now for the Meet the Early Church Father for today is Zachary of Mytilene. Now, Zachary of Mytilene is known also by, as Zachary Scholasticus. Zachary Scholasticus. So if you ever run across that name, just know that Zachary of Mytilene. He was born in a port city near Gaza, and he was perhaps the brother of a philosopher sophist named Procopius of Gaza. Around the year 485, Zachary was a student in Alexandria, and in autumn of 487, he began his legal studies in what is now today the city of Beirut. So he goes to Beirut, he learns legal studies, and around 492 AD, he settles in Constantinople, where, in his pursuit in the legal profession, he wins the title Scholasticos. Okay. Now, in his early years, Zachary, unfortunately, was infected by heresy known as Monophysism. And we've talked about that in this program. The Monophysites is a Christological heresy, a misunderstanding about Jesus, where they believe that Jesus didn't have a divine and a human nature, two natures, but rather they kind of squished them together so that Jesus has one theanthropic nature, where it's not completely divine and it's not completely human, it's just a mixture of it. Well, unfortunately, Zachary of Mytilene was a Monophysite. He held to that theory. And he was also an admirer of Severus of Antioch, and he wrote a biography of him. Now, our knowledge of Zachary ends right around the year 492, where he's the Monophysite heretic, right? And then there's a break. We don't know what happens after that point until we encounter him again in AD 536, where we find him present at the Synod of Constantinople as the Metropolitan Bishop of Mytilene. So all of a sudden he appears back in history. Now what's interesting here is he's no longer a Monophysite. He's actually someone who supports the Chalcedonian creed, the Chalcedonian understanding, the Orthodox, the correct understanding about Jesus and the Trinity. So he actually condemns the very person that he admired, Severus of Antioch, and others who were Monophysites, and he dies just prior to the Second Council of Constantinople, which is also known as the Fifth Ecumenical Council, in 553. So that's kind of interesting that our biographical information, he apparently underwent some sort of conversion and came out on the right side, but we don't know why. But thanks be to God that he did. We don't have a lot. We only have fragments of what he wrote. And one dissertation he wrote is called The Disputation That the World Is Not Co-Eternal with God. It's a theological treatise, of course, which was written sometime between AD 487 and 492. And I'll give you a little snippet of this this treatise. It's actually a dialogue that a Christian has. It's in the form of a dialogue, I should say, that a Christian has with a person named Emmanuel. Okay. So the Christian says, "We confess that God is the creator and cause of the world." And Emmanuel says, "Hear, hear." The Christian says, "Are you of a mind that the world is co-eternal with God?" And Emmanuel says, "Very much so." So the Christian responds, "Things that are co-eternal are ever co-existent." And immanentist says, so what? Okay. Yeah, things that are co-eternal are coexistent. So what difference does that make? Well, the Christian responds to this. Things that are ever coexistent cannot be the efficient cause of the other, can they? And immanentist says no. If, therefore, the Christian responds, the world was co-eternal with God, as you say it is, it could not be its efficient cause from God, but we agree that God is the creator of the world. And immanentist says, hear, hear. Then the Christian concludes, the world, therefore, cannot be co-eternal with God, for every effect is later in origin and in time than the one affecting it. And that's our quote from Zachary of Mytilene. Well, you know, is the world co-eternal with God? Well, we know through Christian revelation that it's not. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? The heavens and earth didn't coexist or were already in existence. God calls them into existence for nothing. But here's something interesting that you need to think about, is that the arguments for an eternal world is actually quite strong. And although Zachary here provides a pretty good argument for the world not being eternal, philosophically speaking, it's not that hard to dismiss. You really need divine revelation. In fact, this was the point of St. Thomas Aquinas, that really can only be known by God revealing it. All right, coming up next, we're going to have my longtime friend, Master Apologist Steve Ray. You want to listen to this conversation, folks. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you to the upcoming Spiritual Warfare Conference, January 11th and 12th at the Sacred Heart Chapel in downtown Covina. If you go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org, you can join us with that, or call us at 877-526-2151. Jesse Romero will be there, Father Wolfgang will be there, and our very own Matt Arnold will be there, and I'll be the MC. Don't miss out on this wonderful event, January 11th and 12th.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. We desperately need to fix the bugs so you can listen live on our app or YouTube without any glitches. Plus, meet traditional broadcast standards in order to provide our exclusive programming to Catholic radio stations around the country and around the world, absolutely free of charge. As usual, we're doing it all on a shoestring budget, but we cannot do it without you. If you like what you hear on Virgin Most Powerful, I ask you to please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome, everybody, back to Hands-On Apologetics. And as I mentioned, we have on the line one of the best apologists, best Catholic evangelist, best world traveler, pilgrimage guide, just all around great person, and actually someone I admire as a role model, the incomparable Steve Ray. Steve Ray, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Well, thanks, Gary, but I think you got the wrong guy on the phone from that introduction you just gave. I definitely think you have the wrong guy on the phone.
Oh, no, no, I got the right guy on the phone. Don't be modest. You know, it's a joy to talk to you.
I have always admired you as well, Gary, because you were Catholic before me. Obviously, you're a cradle Catholic, but you came to understand the faith and how to battle out apologetics. And I remember your magazine, Hands on Apologetics, and you were there helping us and our family in our journey into the faith. So,
well, thank you.
You are also well loved on this side of the fence.
That's great. Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. Well, you know, just in case somebody was living on the moon or under a rock and they don't know who you are or your journey to the Catholic faith, I was wondering if maybe you could just give us a thumbnail sketch of where you came from and how you got into the church.
I've told my story over 1,000 times at conferences, on pilgrimages, easy 1,000 times, but it's always an hour long, so I know I don't have that much time, so I'll do a thumbnail sketch. My mom and dad were pagans, good American pagans. Never had any religion at all when they were growing up in Illinois when they were young in the 1920s. And my mom and dad both became Christians due to Billy Graham and heard his message. And my mom said she cried and said, "Save me, God, the way that man just said." And she just turned 97 years old yesterday.
Wow.
And we were there with her, and she still loves to tell the story of how she found Jesus Christ through a Billy Graham crusade. She heard it on the radio. Well, she had 12 years of miscarriages, and she prayed and asked God, now that she found Jesus, to give her kids, and I was born a year later. And they raised me to be a good Baptist kid with my two brothers that followed. And we never missed church. We never missed Sunday school, Wednesday night prayer meeting, Sunday evening hymn sing. And we had to learn Bible verses like John 3:16, "For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life." And I got 50 cents for every Bible verse I memorized when I was a little guy. And then I won't do the whole thing, but I'll give you a start here. Then my mom, when I was about 8 years old, she had us memorize this. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 1 Kings, 1 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Now, I go all the way through, but I don't want to bore your audience. So, but we had to learn the books of the Bible. And at 15, I got rebellious and stubborn and decided I didn't want to be a Christian. The kids that went to our church were not cool. And I was that was in the late 60s. And a lot of people know what was going on in the late 60s with rock and roll and sex and free this and free that. And I got in a lot of trouble. But at 17, I heard Billy Graham on the radio. And I remember getting tears in my eyes. And George Beverly Shea sang at the end of that great talk that Billy Graham had given, and he starts singing, "Just as I am without one plea, but that your blood was shed for me." And I remember getting tears in my eyes and my long hair, hippie, bell-bottom blue jeans. I walked out Napier Road in Plymouth, Michigan, and I said, "Jesus, I'm only a stubborn 17-year-old rebellious kid, but tonight I'm going to give my life to you." That was the most important day of my life. That was the day that set a trajectory for everything else that happened. Never dreamed, Gary, I'd ever become a Catholic, because Catholics were all going to hell as far as we were concerned, and we had to get them all saved.
Right.
But that was where I met Jesus Christ for myself, not just because I was raised that way, where I had an encounter with Jesus Christ. And I loved being a Christian. I just studied the Bible. I loved to learn everything I could about the faith and the truth and the Bible and biblical things. And then when I was 39 years old, the most radical thing happened to me. After introducing himself to me when I was 17 years old, he finally introduced me to his family when I was 39.
Wow. Wow. So, I met you shortly before. I know that the process was already beginning, right?
Yep, and probably the connection was Al Cresta.
Yes, yes, that's right. Al used to have these bridge groups over your house.
Yep, that's where we probably met. We did it at his house one week and at my house the next week, and it had a lot of fruit. We saw 200 people become Catholics in a 2-year period.
Yeah.
after I converted. I know he started that a little before we became Catholics, and that's probably where we met you.
Yes, yeah, Rob Corzine and I. And
yep, and that was back now, in 1993, by the way.
Yes, right. In fact, we were there when you came into church. We were up on the stage
you were.
With you.
Yep.
Just to let the listeners know, these groups were amazing because it was a mixed Catholic-Protestant mix. Elle kind of led them. And I remember there's this one guy that was so fired up for the faith, and it was at his house, that he would run to his library and grab books and like quote things and just completely demolish Protestant arguments. And I'm thinking, man, this guy is a real on-fire Catholic. And it was you. You were still Protestant.
I made sure I knew I was right before I actually came in. But, there was that year of 1993 where my wife and I, we got married young. She was 19, I was 21. We knew each other since we were 17 and 15. But we decided when we got married young that we were going to do everything together and be a team. And this included that. We started to research all of these things and look into them in 1993, partly in reaction to Al Cresta, because him and I had been best friends since 1983. That goes back another 10 or 12 years that we were best friends with him after I'd studied with Francis Schaeffer in Switzerland, a Protestant theologian and philosopher. And I came back all fired up about faith alone and Bible alone and evangelical Protestantism, and we were pro-life and we were going to change the world.
Yeah.
And then this guy named Al Cresta, we met him, and he was also an evangelical pastor. And I wasn't a pastor, but he was a pastor and did a radio show on Protestant radio in Detroit. And we were best friends, homeschooled our kids together, spent two weekends of the month together, and then one day after 10 years or 12 years of all this good friendship, he announces without any warning that him and his wife were going to become Catholic. And I said, Al, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. You're way too smart to be a Catholic. What in the world are you thinking? And he said, Steve, we've been thinking a lot about it, and we decided to go back to the church of my youth. We're going to go back to the Catholic Church. And my wife and I said, let them go. Let them go sit with all that dead wood. Those Catholics, they don't even read their Bible. They don't even know how to sing. Let him go. He'll regret it. In the meantime, we're going to study to prove him wrong. And in the process of a year of studying to prove him wrong, we proved him right.
So this wasn't you got warm fuzzies and decided to, to swim the Tiber.
I don't do warm fuzzies.
That's true, you don't. But it was more like kicking and screaming. And when I say, folks, he did his research, he did his research.
In fact, Gary, I'll tell you, too,
go ahead.
That I'm a rebel at heart. I've always been countercultural, politically incorrect. I always pride myself in not following the crowd, of being a rebel, basically, at heart. I was a rebel when I was a kid. I was a rebel when I was a hippie teenager. I was a rebel when I was an evangelical. But when I became Catholic, the study of that, it on one side, scared us because I realized that there was something there, and it had a history going back 2,000 years, which my evangelical Protestantism is only a couple hundred years. It's still in diapers in a way. And being researching the Catholic Church, it was scary because it was going to radically reshape our whole life. And that meant we'd lose all of our friends and our family and everything else if we ever went in that direction. But at the other side, the rebellion in me, the rebel, in a good way. I always teach my kids now and my grandkids to be a rebel, to rebel against a culture of death, to rebel against a society that goes hedonistically headlong down for themselves and for pleasure and for drugs and sex and whatever else, to be a rebel against that, to teach your kids to rebel against that culture. And so the rebel in me started to come up, and I kind of liked it. I said, man, for me to be really countercultural, the best way to do that is to become an authentic Catholic.
Yeah,
and that's what we did.
True. Yeah, and part of all that research, you put together your first book, which I highly recommend to the audience. It's called Crossing the Tiber. Which that was made from your study notes, wasn't it, or a correspondence?
Yeah, well, it started as a letter to my father because my dad, when he heard that I was reading Catholic books and even thinking about this, he clenched his fists and he just held his breath. His face turned red. The veins popped out of his neck. And he said, you must be backslidden. You must be living in sin to even think about these things. And I remember him doing that in the living room at our house. And my dad was the best father in the world. I could tell stories about my dad that make me and you cry, but I won't do that here. Maybe on another show we'll talk about parenting or something. But
yeah,
I remember
absolutely.
my dad being so upset, and I was just brokenhearted that I had hurt my dad. So I sat down and I started to write a letter on my old computer back then, and it started out, "Dear Dad, you're the best father in the world, and I owe you an explanation." And I typed and I typed and I typed, and it ended up being the book Crossing the Tiber.
Yeah, yeah, that's
it was a letter to my dad. It was a love letter. And an interesting thing was, when we decided to become Catholics, Janet and I, our two oldest kids, Cindy and Jesse, they were 16 and 13. We homeschooled them, bright kids. They said, "We're not going to join with you." I said, "Why not?" "Dad, did you forget what you taught us in homeschooling about the Catholic Church? You told us it was the Whore of Babylon and the Pope was the Antichrist and that it's a counterfeit of real Christianity, and you think we're going to join it now?" Well, I had just written the major part of that letter to my father. I wrote that before. Most of Crossing the Tiber was written before I was a Catholic. It was about what we were thinking as we were coming that way. And I said to Cindy and Jesse, I said, "Would you do me a favor? I just wrote a letter to Grandpa, and I would like you to proofread it for me before I give it to him. I may be dumb, Gary, but I'm not stupid." I gave them that letter. And they took that letter upstairs at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They did not come down for dinner. I said to Janet, "Leave them alone. They're reading that letter. They must be impacted by it. Leave them alone." 10 o'clock, they came down with tears running down their cheeks, and they said, "Dad, that was a good letter. We just had a meeting upstairs, and we decided we're going to join with you." So they were the first two converts as a result of that book before it was ever a book.
Wow. That's fantastic. And you raised them well. You know, they didn't just follow the leader. You know, they checked it out for themselves.
Yeah, and, you know, but we were radical parents, even as evangelical Protestants. I never had a television. My father did not get me a television when I was a boy. He said, "We're going to read books in this house." And I never had a television for our kids. We never had television. I said, "We're going to read books in this house." And what I love now is that my kids are raising my 16 grandchildren, and none of them have televisions.
Beautiful.
They all read books together. And I would say right now, listening, if you want to raise a good Catholic family, one of the first things you do is get rid of that television, because it's your worst enemy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, you know, that also spawned your second book, and actually we're coming up to a break. But your book, Upon This Rock, I think remains one of the best books defending the papacy. And you just came out with a new book on the papacy. So on the other side of the break, I want to talk to you about what led you to write this book, what's the difference between the two, and maybe we can dig into some scripture. How's that sound?
Alrighty. Let's do it.
All right. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics. You want to stay tuned for the incomparable Steve Ray talking about his best subject, one of his best subjects, Peter and the Papacy. Stay tuned.
Matthew Arnold here, encouraging you to go to vmpr.org to register for our upcoming Spiritual Warfare Conference this January 11th and 12th at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. Father Wolfgang will be speaking along with Jesse Romero, Terry Barber as MC, and yours truly, talking about spiritual warfare and the family. Protect your family now. Go to vmp.org and register for this conference. Don't miss it.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. We desperately need to fix the bugs so you can listen live on our app or YouTube without any glitches. Plus, meet traditional broadcast standards in order to provide our exclusive programming to Catholic radio stations around the country and around the world, absolutely free of charge. As usual, we're doing it all on a shoestring budget, but we cannot do it without you. If you like what you hear on Virgin Most Powerful, I ask you to please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking to the incomparable Steve Ray, master apologist, world traveler. The list goes on and on. And when we left off, we were talking about Steve Ray's second book, Upon This Rock. And Steve, I remember I did a talk at Domino's Farms, and you were there, and you had a volume of one of the anti-Nicene fathers, and you were marking up the text of all the juicy quotes that you're finding in the early church father. I bet that was part of that book, because that book is so well researched.
Well, it started out, interestingly enough, as I was found a quote from one of the early church fathers. I think it was Ignatius of Antioch. And I said to my wife, wow, look at this. They believed in the papacy, the chair of Peter in Rome, from the first century. I'm going to print this out on parchment and frame it and put it on the wall. And then I found another one. Oops. And I said, oh, I'm going to make two quotes on that parchment and put it in a frame on the wall. And then I found a third one, and when I printed that, it went onto a second page, and it wouldn't fit on that paper I was going to frame and put on the wall. And I said to my wife, you know what? I'm going to look up all of these passages. I want to demonstrate that the early church believed in the primacy of Peter, in the chair of Peter in Rome, because for me, the whole conversion process dealt with authority. It all had to do with authority. It didn't have to do with Mary and the Eucharist and contraception or any of those things. It all hinged on authority, because once you deal with the authority issue, everything else falls into place. So when I started getting those quotes, I started collecting them all. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to put a footnote for each one of these quotes explaining who that person was and why it is significant that they said what they just said in support of the primacy of Peter, and I'm going to look for any quotes I can find against it. And guess what I found? None against it, but all of the early church supported, believed in, and defended the primacy of Peter in Rome. Now, some of them may not have liked what the early popes said. Sure. They may even have argued with some of their conclusions, but never did they deny that the Bishop of Rome had the right and authority to say it and to exercise that authority. That's how that book got started. Well, since Ignatius Press had already published Catholic Convert with all its footnotes in it, they said, let's do this book too. Go ahead and finish it. We want a lot of footnotes, and make it a source material. So the book was really not a book about it, but it was a book collecting all of the original source material, the verbatim quotes of the early fathers. Then I decided I'm going to go back to the Bible and show all of the passages that Protestants and the Eastern Orthodox use against us Catholics, and I'm going to show how that's really disingenuous, and those passages really support the papacy if you understand them in their historical context. And so I started putting all that together, and Ignatius said, good book, we'll publish it, and that's how that one got started.
Wow. I didn't know that. So it originally started out as a source book, but
It still is a source book, and people say, it's got so many footnotes. Why? I said, because it's a collection of source material. So here in the first century, Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, the Didache, all these things, and then I explain who they are, why it's important, and I probably use as many or more Protestant sources to prove my point than I do Catholic, because my book was really set on giving Catholics a source material, but letting them know that even the Protestants don't argue, they have to accept it. At least the scholars do, not the fundamentalist Looney Tunes, but the real scholar Protestants have to admit these things. So I collected all of that, and that's how it got started.
Well, you know, since we're on that topic, Where would you go in Scripture to establish the papacy? Is there any favorite passage?
Well, you know, a lot of people want to go to Matthew chapter 16. Mm-hmm. It says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church." I have a whole talk on that. It's called Peter, the Rock, the Keys, and the Chair. And it's all based on the biblical. But, you know, I often say when I start the talk and we go to Matthew 16, which is where Jesus tells Peter in Caesarea Philippi that you're going to be the rock, and on this rock I'll build my church, and I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, that we go to that passage to say this is where it was established. But I would have to say that that's only a nice passage that supports it, because the whole issue of there being a man in charge, a royal steward in charge of the kingdom of God, was organically involved. You don't need Matthew 16 to prove it, because it's organically the way Jesus founded his church, and it's all based on the Old Testament. Mm. For example, in the Old Testament, you had the king, and the king always had a second in command. He was called the royal steward, or the one over the house of the king. And the king had a set of keys. They're called the keys of the kingdom. They belong to the king. And you didn't take them up to Kmart or Aco Hardware and have them duplicated, because there was only one set of those keys. And they were big, long 2x4 keys. They weren't like cool keys like we have today when carrying a pocket. These were big keys that they would hang over their shoulder, and when they walked, they'd go clank, clank, bang, bang. And everybody, it said in Isaiah 22, would bow to the royal steward. They called him the father of Jerusalem. He had a special office and a robe, and he carried the keys of the kingdom and represented the king, and everybody bowed to him with the authority that and the respect that they would bow to the king. Jesus has become the king. He is in Nazareth at the Annunciation, where I've been 150 times to that place, where the angel said to Mary, "You're going to give birth to Jesus, and he's going to sit on the throne of his father David." There'd been no king on the throne of Israel for over 600 years, and now the first king in that line is being born. And as soon as Jesus decides he's going to build his kingdom, and right before he goes down to Jerusalem to be crucified, he gives to Peter that authority. He's basically saying, "Peter, I am the king of a new kingdom, and kings of Israel always delegate the authority of their kingdom in the form of the keys to their royal steward. And since I'm going to be dying very soon and raising and going up to heaven, John 14, I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you unto myself. I'm going to be leaving to prepare that place. So you're going to represent me on the earth, and here I'm delegating you the keys. My keys, you be in charge." Keys represent exclusive dominion. It's not a shared dominion. Those keys are controlled by one man, and when he dies, they went to the successor. And that's how it worked in Israel. You don't need Matthew 16 to establish the papacy. It's the organic way that God built his church, because the church is the new Israel. So, of course, it's going to have authority similar to the first Israel.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, right. And I love your phrase, exclusive dominion, because car owners, you know that if you have the keys to your car, that means you have exclusive access to it. You know, you have
exactly. And here's the example I use when I give my talk. My favorite place to give this talk is at Caesarea Philippi, right on the border with Lebanon, which is where this happened. And I'm at the rock where Jesus made this announcement. But I say to the people, if you are going, I can't go out and get your car and move into your house and take it over. Why? Because you own the keys and they represent your ownership and authority. But if you come to me and say, "Steve, I'm going on vacation and I need someone to take care of the dog, so here's the keys to my car and my keys to my house. Would you please drive to my house and move in and take care of the dog before me and stay there and take care of my house?" Now I do, because you delegated to me the keys of your car and your house. But when you come back home, I have to give those keys back to you. And there's a painting in Rome which shocked me the first time I saw it, because always you see Peter clutching the keys. "Jesus gave me these keys. I'm his representative here on earth. I'm the vicar of Christ, and I'm going to do my job." And you see it everywhere. He's clutching those keys, and he's his fervor to do the job he's been given as the royal steward. But in this painting, Peter's given the keys away, kind of this cavalier giving the keys away. And I thought for a second, oh, my goodness, it was the judgment scene in the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican. And Michelangelo understood Jesus is coming back on the great day of judgment. And Peter, seeing Jesus came back from vacation, he has to give him back the keys to the car and the house. And that's what that painting is, see? So Michelangelo understood the idea of the keys of the kingdom. And that's exactly what Jesus did. So Matthew 16 helps us understand it, but it certainly is not necessary for the papacy.
Yeah, and that's a great image because, you know, ultimately, Jesus is also the prime minister. He has the keys to the kingdom of David. We know that in Revelation. And by that ownership, he's the one that delegates the keys to Peter.
Yep.
And then, like that painting, kind of completes the circle. At Day of Judgment, the keys go back to their owner.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So we only have a couple more minutes before our next break. But so I recommend this book and all of Steve Ray's material to you. In fact, how would they get a hold of your material before I forget?
It's all on my website, CatholicConvert.com. I have a web store on there. You go to CatholicConvert.com. Up at the top, it says products. There's a whole store there that I have. And, you know, I have also a movie that I made on location in all those places called Peter, Keeper of the Keys. It's in my yes. Footprints of God documentary series. And I take you to all of those places, Caesarea Philippi. I show you that rock, and it's all in that movie, defending and explaining the office of Peter as the Bishop of Rome. And my book, Upon This Rock, is also there. And talks I've given, too, are there on audio called Peter, the Rock, the Keys, and the Chair. But Catholic Convert, and go to the products page.
Yeah, you definitely want to frequent this. And listen up, apologist. Steve Ray's website, CatholicConvert.com, has one of the best apologetic forums out there. It's huge. And you definitely want to take advantage of that.
Yep, we enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Now, I wrote another book. It just came out this month in October. I think it's shipping now. I have received copies, but others said that it's back ordered. It's still being prepared, but it's called The Papacy, What the Pope Does and Why It Matters. And in the current situation we're living in today with the church, I think it's kind of an interesting title and an interesting book.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about a timely title.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah, so, we're going to be coming up on the break. So I don't want to get started on the new book right now. But if anybody has any questions for Steve Ray or would like to be on the forums, you could always put your questions. Give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. We're talking to Steve Ray about his new book on the papacy. You definitely do not want to change that dial if you're listening on a dial device, that is, because we got a lot more coming at you. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber. I want to invite you to the Spiritual Warfare Conference coming January 11th and 12th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. It's going to be fantastic. I want to encourage you to sign up by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. One of the speakers is sitting right next to me, Matthew Arnold. Matt, what are you going to be telling our folks about?
I'm going to tell them about my journey into the Catholic Church because in my younger days, I was in the entertainment business. I was all involved with cult beliefs and practices like tarot cards and astrology and even channeling. And I had my own brush with the demonic.
Wow. Not only Matt, but Father Wolfgang from the Opus Angelorum, popular priest, he's welcome back. And our friend Jesse Romero, my partner on the Terry and Jesse Show, will be there. Don't miss it. Go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call us at 877-526-2151.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. As usual, we're doing it all on a shoestring budget, but we cannot do it without you. If you like what you hear on Virgin Most Powerful, I ask you to please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking with Steve Ray, and we're talking about Peter and the Papacy, and also Steve Ray's new book. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-526-2151. And I beg you, if you are interested in defending the faith and you haven't already done it, please visit his website, CatholicConvert.com. You will not regret it. It has lots of stellar, golden information, articles, things like that. And Steve, yeah, right before the break, we were talking about how, well, I mean, with the papacy throughout history, there has always been misunderstanding. Some people make too much of the Pope and his authority. Some people make too little. So, you know, we're living in a very confusing age. So I'm glad you wrote the book on the papacy. Are you there, Steve?
I had the snooze button there in case I sneezed while I was back on.
Well, that's okay. You wouldn't be the first one to snooze on my show. So.
No, I don't mean snooze. I mean a sneeze or whatever. You know, I was talking to my wife, and I didn't want to be on the air. So we got back from the break. So, this book that I wrote, I did it in conjunction with a good friend of mine, Dennis Walters. I think you know him as well.
Oh, yeah.
He's a deacon, and he was a good friend of mine that helped me understand and learn things Catholic as we became Catholics. I may have known about the apologetics and the Bible angle, but I didn't know what a ciborium was. So he took us under his wing and for a couple of weeks took us on tour of Catholic Church and through the Missal and helped us to understand all the things Catholic. So we wrote this book together because he's quite the scholar about these things, and I had a lack of time. So we worked together on that, and I think we came out with a pretty good book. It was originally kind of conceived as a study guide with Catholic answers, but we developed it into a full-blown book and remastered the whole thing, and it's published by Ignatius Press now. And it's called The Papacy, What the Pope Does and Why It Matters. And in the current chaos that's coming out of the Vatican, I don't want to be too radical here, but I find this papacy to be quite confusing, quite disorienting for people, and certainly not going in the direction I think that the Church should be going. So it makes this book coming out at this time quite interesting and quite a topic of discussion.
Yeah, so give us a little preview about what's in the book, because you said it's not quite released or it's about to be released?
It's been published, and I have my copies, and I think you can get it now. I just don't know if it's in the bookstores yet. You know, it's one of those things where it's kind of it's done and it's in the warehouse. Whether bookstores have it yet or not, I don't know. I have 150 copies of it. But, well, what it is it's an attempt, whereas my first book, I wanted to go through intensely all of the biblical passages and bring in the fathers of the church and the Jewish background and the cultural background and explain that. And then the first 8 centuries of the church to show that all Christians recognized Peter as the prime and the primacy of Rome. It was unquestioned. The layout of that book. And it's much more detailed than my second book on the papacy. Much more scholarly, I would say, with footnotes and documentation and everything else. This book is more of a simple read. It's more for the average Catholic who wants to understand the papacy from A to Z. How did we get a pope? What's the biblical background for it? How was a pope elected? Who were the great popes? Were there popes that are problems? What does the pope do? Why should I care what the pope does? Does he have authority in the church? What's his obligation? What does infallibility mean? These kind of issues. And a list of all the popes, 266 over the last 2,000 years. So, and a glossary of terms related to the papacy and the Bishop of Rome. So this book is more of a, if somebody wants to get the A to Z of the papacy and understand it by looking at it from every angle, this is a good book. This is what will help them understand it from beginning to end, and what is the papacy, why we have it, what the pope does, and why it matters. So that's what this book basically covers.
Well, it sounds like it covers an awful lot.
It does, and in a simple way. I don't mean to downplay the content, but I'm making the point that this is a book that any Catholic could pick up and read. It's not that long. It's, it's about 160 pages, mm-hmm. 165 pages. A lot of scripture. Any passages related to the papacy are dealt with in here. There's an index in the back. You can go and look up the biblical passages and come back to it. There's a nice index of keywords and everything used in the book. And it's laid out, I think, in nice chapters that progressively take you through so that it's an easy book for the average Catholic to read and understand everything papacy.
Right. And, you know, it's important to have a clear understanding because people can get things wrong. I mean, after all, there was the ultramontanes that believed every time the pope spoke, it was guarded by infallibility and authoritative. And you have other people that would go the opposite end, that basically he's just the first among equals, and, you know, he has his own jurisdiction. That's about it. So,
and isn't it just one church of many? It's just you're bigger than the rest of them, you know? So
right, exactly.
It starts out with a couple of scenarios. You're on the day of Pentecost. You're in Jerusalem. There's a wind blowing through the city of Jerusalem, and you hear it and you feel it. And what the heck is that? And all of a sudden, out from Mount Zion, from the upper room, Peter and John and the apostles come out, and they start to preach. And everybody understands it in their own language, even though they're from all parts of the world as far away as Arabia, it says. And they're all listening, and Peter preaches, and they decide this Jesus must be the Messiah, and the Holy Spirit is demonstrating it with his power here. Now, what happens the day after? You have three basic scenarios. Number one is everybody said, this is a great spiritual experience. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to pray and meditate on this, and I'm just going to relish this emotional high that I've had. And there's no church, there's no structure, there's no organization. Everybody just goes to their own house and they start to pray and meditate and sing, you know. And within a generation, it would have been gone because there was no structure, nothing to keep it moving forward. Or it could have been those 12 apostles came out of the upper room and they began to preach and they all started their independent Baptist churches. One guy goes all over the world and starts the Baptist church. Another guy goes and starts the Presbyterian church. Another guy goes and starts the Methodist church, or all these, and all of these competing groups of the, you know, I'm the church of Andrew, I'm the church of Nathaniel. And it would have been chaos, a lot like what Protestantism is today. Mm-hmm. And they would have just not survived the first generation because there wouldn't have been the structure, the unity. We know that together you stand, divided you fall. And there would not have been the unity. The third scenario is that Peter stands up and said, this is something God has started. We're the new Israel. But here's an interesting thing, Gary. In the upper room, there was 120, it says. 120 were in the upper room, but when you read it in the original, it says that there were about 120 names in the upper room. Well, I thought that was very strange. Why does it say 120 names and not 120 people? Well, I started to do research in the Jewish culture and tradition of the first century and found in the Mishnah, which is a collection of Jewish traditions, that if a group in a major city, a society, wants to break away and start their own new city with their own courts and their own laws and their own government, they have to have at least 120 people before they can do that. 120 were required to break away and start their own new society. What's happening in the upper room? They're breaking away and they're starting the ecclesia, the called out ones, a new society. They're breaking away from Israel itself and the Sanhedrin there. They're going to start a new society, and they needed 120 people, and Luke says that they had them, even a list of their names. How many men do you think today are sitting in the Knesset, which is the Parliament of Israel? 120.
Really?
And so,
oh, wow.
So what happens here is it's showing you that they didn't just go out and start independent groups. They didn't just go out and have meditation and prayer and song like many Protestant groups would think happened. What they did is they're breaking away from one society with courts and laws and judges and binding and loosing and the whole structure of a city. It's a civic organization. They're breaking away and starting their own. They need their own courts, their own ability to adjudicate, to legislate. They have to have leaders. They have to have the head guy. That's exactly what Peter is. So when you look at the church, what happened, the third scenario is the one that happened. These people broke away with Peter in the head and the apostles, and they started their own new community, and that community continues to exist today with Peter still in charge through the papacy, and that's called the Catholic Church. And yes, that's how we start the book.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, with the collection of rabbis, there was always a head rabbi who was the Nasi, or the prince of the synagogue. And he could bind and loose the decisions of the other rabbis within the council.
So, and there we get the whole idea of the papacy. And like I said earlier in the show, we don't need Matthew 16. It's the way the Jewish society worked. And in Christianity, the church is the new Israel. It's the new Jewish society. So you're going to expect it to have the same source of authorities, the same structure, and that's exactly what the Catholic Church is. It is the heir of Judaism.
Right. Wow, that's great. You know, we only have a couple more minutes. I want to get to a couple other points. You mentioned in your book that here's a question for you, Steve. Is the Pope beyond criticism?
I put a section in there, especially under Pope Francis. I went back and rewrote a section there because I felt that we had to address that issue. Under Pope John Paul II and Benedict doesn't mean that they did everything perfect, but that issue really never arose in my mind and in most Orthodox Catholics' minds. But under this papacy, it has become a big issue. And so I have a section in there, can the Pope be criticized? And I say, yes, he can. And I give biblical and patristic evidence of that. First of all, Paul says in Galatians chapter 2, Paul confronted Peter to his face because he stood condemned. Paul was not the Pope. Peter was the head of the church. And Paul felt the freedom to go and confront him. Augustine and Aquinas use that example and others to say that we have an obligation not to go and be critical of everything, not to go in there with an attitude of rebellion and dissident hatred or something, but with due respect and deference to the office of Peter. Even if the Pope is doing something wrong, we still approach it with deference and respect. And he said that, but we have the obligation. If the prelate is doing something wrong, we have the obligation to confront him about it. Catherine of Siena, who was a woman who felt perfectly at ease confronting the Pope who had moved to Avignon, France, and said, you need to get back to Rome. And she castigated him in very strong terms, and she became a doctor of the church. So I did add a section in there about the Pope. Now, I also...
I hear the music, Steve. I got to stop you. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
But I want the people to know, where can they get this new book?
I have it. I'm going to have it up on my website in a couple days, and they can also order it through Ignatius Press. Ignatius.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for coming on the program. Tomorrow, we're going to have blue-collar apologist John Martinoni. You don't want to miss it. This is Gary Machuda signing off from Hands on Apologetics, the Apologetics Dojo. Coming up next, the Terry and Jesse Show. God bless everybody, and thank you for listening.
Scripture tells us that David beat Goliath with a sling and 5 smooth stones. Funny. The rosary looks kind of like that. The rosary is a Catholic devotional prayer. A set of 1 Our Father followed by 10 Hail Marys is called a decade. You do 5 decades and you have a rosary. And for each decade, we meditate on a mystery from Jesus' life. So the prayers we're breathing in and out set the stage for an encounter with the Word of God. Do a quick search online for the mysteries of the rosary, which are different for each day of the week. What I really love about old-school Catholic devotionals like this is simplicity. I'll be honest, it's not always easy to pray or to lead my family in prayer. What do I do? What do I say? Rosary, problem solved. Look, every family's a mess in its own special way. Bring God into the mess. Your family's problems might be Goliaths. Maybe the solution's as simple as a sling and 5 smooth stones. This is Chris Stefanik from RealLifeCatholic.com.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.